Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's gonna hate you, and she's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio Network. It's December 2nd, 2014. This is Nature Bats Last. It's NBL on PRN.FM, and we are at Turnersoul Farms in Mule Creek, New Mexico this week. Our theme song, Nature Bats Last, is provided with our thanks to by Afrazin. You can find more of his work, of course, at SoundCloud at SoundCloud.com. I'm Mike Saliba, along with the good Dr. Guy McPherson. On tonight's show, we touch upon the NFL, drone strikes from the Empire, guys' travels and presentations abroad, our latest Doomer of the Week, and, of course, the climate update and summary. But first, as always, we start with news beyond the echo chamber and beyond the mainstream. Guy, let's start.
Thanks, Mike. I'll start with a story from Liberty Blitzkrieg. Last Tuesday, Michael Krieger posted this headline, U.S. drone strike math, 41 terrorists targeted, 1,147 people killed. Krieger quotes The Guardian from November 24th as follows, quote, a new analysis of the data available to the public about drone strikes conducted by the human rights group Reprieve indicates that even when operators target specific individuals, the most focused effort of what Barack Obama calls targeted killing, they kill vastly more people than their targets, often needing to strike multiple times. Attempts to kill 41 men resulted in the deaths of an estimated 1,147 people as of November 24th, end quote. According to a November 26th article at CNN.com, drone pilots are in demand and are able to earn $100,000 per year in the private sector. We can only hope the success rate in the corporate world exceeds the rate in the military, which stands at below 4%. Mike, back to you.
All right. Thanks, Guy. My story is a rarity. It's a good story, good news out of the National Football League, and it's from Daily Kos, and the headline reads, 29-year-old leaves NFL and $37 million contract to become farmer in order to feed the hungry. St. Louis Rams center Jason Brown has left the NFL to pursue, yes, you guessed it, farming. Back in 2009, Brown signed a $37.5 million contract with the Rams, making him the highest-paid center in all of football. He earned about $25 million of that contract and decided to leave the final year's $12.5 million on the table. Instead, he bought 1,000 acres of farmland in North Carolina. Brown is doing this to help the less fortunate. He grows sweet potatoes and other vegetables and donates his harvest to food pantries. According to the New and Observer, he has given away 46,000 pounds of sweet potatoes and 10,000 pounds of cucumbers this fall. Keep in mind that the fact that Brown left the NFL at age 29, he was going to probably get another huge contract to play a few more years. Instead, in 2012, Brown began watching YouTube videos about farming in order to learn how to farm. He calls his farm the First Fruits Farm, and it's not only fruits and vegetables. He says, my agent told me, you're making the biggest mistake of your life, Brown told CBS. And I looked right back at him and said, no, I'm not. No, I'm not. It's interesting. I posted this on my Facebook wall, and I got a little bit of feedback. And some people are concerned with that he pulled the plug in the NFL a little too early. In other words, he could have made a lot more money and therefore have fed a lot more people. I think what people fail to realize is a window of opportunity, and life changes quickly. If you don't jump through that window, sometimes what you want to do never quite happens. And my proof is just looking around at the culture that we live in. Today,
yeah, if I can just comment on that, we're all about the money, and this culture is all about the money. So the idea that somebody would forego a little bit of money to start doing some positive action is anathema to this culture. And I'm reminded of the words I frequently use when communicating with people about all kinds of actions that they propose to take. Do it. Live here now. Don't worry about the future that probably never will come and certainly will never come in the way that you expect. The future's not like that.
Absolutely, and I think both Guy and I can relate to that a little bit. We had a window of opportunity to go out and pursue another living arrangement, and we did so, and we both hear constantly from folks that, boy, I wish I could have done that, but, and that's usually what gets in the way, is people keep thinking it's down the road, and sometimes it's staring you right in the face. So I congratulate this young man. This week, we have a little bit of a different interview. We're going to actually catch up with Guy and talk about his travels and his speaking tours over the last few months since we began the show back in August, and kind of get a recap of what's been going on out there with his audiences and some of the feedback he's receiving and his feelings about his work and the climate at large, obviously. So we'll start and talk a little bit about that and see where it goes. And, of course, we'll get to our Doomer of the Week later on and a little bit of a climate summary if we do not cover it in the interview. So we'll start with interviewing Guy. Why don't we start with some of the places you've been since August, when we started the show first week of August of this year. And you've been actually pretty busy because I haven't seen you all that much. So tell us, why don't you tell us where you've been?
Well, part of that not seeing each other is because you've been kind of busy, too. You've been on the road, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. In late September, early October, I took a trip to Northern California, starting in Santa Cruz, going to Chico, Hayward, and then north to Ashland, Oregon. My host for that trip, Peter Melton, organized more than 20 formal events in the span of 13 days and another 10 informal events. By informal, I mean meeting people for coffee, meeting people for breakfast, talking about the topics I discuss in my presentations in a little bit more informal atmosphere. Took a trip in November, just back from that a week ago, to the same area again with Peter. We added Davis and San Francisco the latter for the Earth at Risk conference. And between those two California trips, I was in New Zealand on both islands for about 2 weeks. I was hosted by Kevin Hester, who arranged about a dozen events in a couple of weeks in New Zealand. He also conscripted a professional filmmaker into creating a documentary of the tour. That's forthcoming. Between those trips, I do the radio show, of course, with you, and I'm interviewed by others for print and broadcast media. I also served as a guest on Carolyn Baker's ongoing webinar about relationships. I'm in the midst of creating a webinar myself focused on abrupt climate change and how individuals can respond to what's going on in the world. So that's it so far.
Your speaking tours are generally arranged by a host, and that host you stay with kind of helps organize the event, obviously, and helps, you know, I guess, bring in the audience and promote the event. Is that something that is good, bad, indifferent? And what has been your experience with generally having a host and having, you know, not necessarily traditional audiences where you're up on stage, but audiences where, like you've mentioned, you're sitting for coffee and maybe in somebody's living room?
Well, there's a lot there. I essentially require somebody to organize a series of events on my behalf, just because I don't have time and I don't have the connections every place that I travel to. So there's an essay at my website, GuyMcPherson.com, called Another Offer to Help. And if you read that essay, it indicates that in exchange for travel expenses and the opportunity to reach some people, I will come to your neighborhood and do a tour. And I try to keep it as inexpensive as possible by eating at the tables of my hosts and staying in their spare room. And for me, that does a lot more than keep the cost low. It allows me to connect with people at a much more meaningful level than I would were I staying in a motel and meeting with the hosts and the organizers and so on for a few minutes before each presentation, a few minutes after. For me, that just doesn't make much sense. I actually enjoy interacting with people, especially like-minded people, and this gives me an opportunity to do so. It puts a lot of work on somebody else's shoulders. It's no small task to organize a series of events. And obviously, if I'm going to the effort to travel someplace, I want to participate in as many events as possible. Now, this latest trip to California was funded by Earth at Risk because they were covering my costs for participating in the conference. And so what that means is Peter Melton gets me for free. Now, he's an events coordinator in his professional life. So that's great because it gives him a special skill set that facilitates him generating a bunch of events. He's also had a previous career as a sports broadcaster, so he's a superb communicator with a degree in communications. And so having somebody like that who can and will create a bunch of events is just fantastic. I really enjoy traveling with him, obviously, or I wouldn't have done it twice in a row right. For a couple of weeks each time. So I enjoy interacting with people on a fairly intimate level, as I do with my hosts, and having all kinds of wide-ranging conversations and then meeting up with any number of people for minutes, hours, sometimes a few days when I stay in their homes along the way. It's really quite an amazing experience for me, and if I would dare write it up, it would make great fodder for a book.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, if somebody were to take on a hosting, responsibility, what advice, now that you've been doing this for a while, because you've seen and probably experienced, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly, what experience would or suggestions would you give somebody before taking on setting up, you know, potential speaking engagements for you and taking on, you know, like you said, it's a great deal of work. So what does that involve?
Well, just know that it's a great deal of work. It's going to take quite a bit of time, and that as a host and organizer, you're going to get a lot of pushback. A lot of people have invited me, and then they talk with their neighbors, and they try to arrange venues, and they discover that the kinds of things I speak about are not the kinds of people are not the kinds of things people want to hear.
Yeah.
So I've been invited and then uninvited from five continents.
That's got to be some sort of
Record. No kidding. Asia, Africa, North America, Europe,
yeah.
Australia, and the only two I'm missing so far are Antarctica and South America.
Yeah.
So that's a lot. So people discover what I'm actually going to be talking about, and the host, the person who invited me, suddenly meets a lot of resistance from their neighbors.
Right.
So I would suggest that you have to be relatively strong-willed if you're going to put up with the idea of putting me up and putting up with me. Beyond that, and so that's the first hurdle that you have to get over. And then the next hurdle is finding venues. So, okay, so you know, you're willing to take the flack from your friends, in many cases, ex-friends.
And who you thought were radical.
Right, exactly. Who claim to be radical because,
right,
you know, they voted Democratic their whole life.
And they like that word transition.
Right. And so I'm going to show up. Now what? Well, now you got to find a bunch of venues, and sometimes they're free and sometimes they're not. And if they're not, then you're going to have to raise money for them. That typically involves just putting a jar out and asking for donations. And generally that covers all the costs and then some, but there's no guarantees.
So we're talking like libraries and places?
Public libraries, universities. A lot of universities will have me on their campus. If there's a university nearby, contacting university faculty is a great idea. And I frequently do classroom visits for 2 to 10 times during a speaking tour. Lodges such as, many different organizations have venues that are intended for public events, but that are relatively little used.
Okay.
So I speak a lot of times in libraries, but then there'll be the occasional Elks Hall or Moose Lodge or IOOF Hall or something like that.
Greer must like that. They're lodges.
Oh, yeah. At least there are lodges involved.
That's right. So let's talk about your audiences a little. The other day I noticed on Facebook, or maybe it was a blog, you posted some numbers that kind of break down percentages of what a standard audience might look like for you, and I was wondering if you could share that with our audience.
Yeah, typically 10 to 20% of the people have been following my work, have seen YouTube clips, have read my writing, and they're there because I'm in the area, and they want to meet me, and they want to chat with me a little bit. Sometimes I want to get their picture taken with me. And so they already know what I'm going to say, and they're fully on board with the notion of near-term human extinction. And then another 10 or 20% of the people who are there are not impressed in the least. And they are there to argue with me.
Right.
And not by presenting any evidence, just to point out frequently that I must be wrong, because they can't imagine this happening this quickly, certainly not in their lifetime.
Right.
No, as nearly as I can tell, nobody is going to die in their lifetime.
Wait,
how could that be?
Right.
And then the middle portion, maybe 70%, maybe 80% of the people, know about climate change. They accept that climate change is underway, that it's anthropogenic, it's happening, but they had no idea it was this bad.
Right.
They're in the category of linear climate change, which is what we hear from the mainstream media all the time. They're in the group of people who think that the governments of the world are doing something about it, are capable of doing something about climate change, and are actually doing something about climate change to make things better. And they had no idea that we were in the midst of abrupt climate change, that abrupt climate change could be happening, and in fact is happening right now. And so a pretty significant majority of the people in the typical audience is blown away, because as with every one of the last four generations, they think climate change is a problem for the grandchildren.
Right.
So, you know, as a grandchild once, I suppose I still am. But I was a young grandchild once, and I remember hearing that with respect to all kinds of problems and predicaments, it would be a problem for my generation, for the grandchildren. And I still keep hearing the same thing. It's a problem for the grandchildren. Well, guess what? Some of us are all grown up now. Right. I mean, to the extent we're going to be. And it's a problem today. I mean, we face tremendous issues with respect to limits to growth, with respect to climate disaster, with respect to the sixth great extinction, and so on, you know, fouling the air and dirtying the water. All those things are getting worse. None of them are getting any better. And they're staring us right in the face. Not in a generation, not in two generations from now, as the IPCC would have us believe, but right now.
Right. So let's talk about that 70%, because really that's the, you know, that's the large portion of your audience. And recently you've become a certified grief recovery specialist, and I'm assuming you've done that because of the 70%. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the approach you take now, because obviously when you pass on that sort of information to people, they start going through various stages.
Yes, and I actually participated in that certification workshop for a couple of reasons. One, because I was pretty screwed up in the head, and I didn't really understand why. And within a few hours of the beginning of the workshop, I realized that we have a name for this. It's called grief. I had no idea. We're such a grief-denying culture that we really, I mean, it's one of those things that we just rarely talk about. It doesn't come up in polite conversation because we don't like to talk about things like that are associated with loss. Especially the big loss, you know, the final nap, as it were. And so it was really, really beneficial for me personally in ways that I couldn't have imagined in advance. But the real reason I participated in it was not for me, even though it turned out to be hugely beneficial, but for my audience, because I knew that I was pretty far down the road of left brain, uber science geek. Mm-hmm. And I knew that my bedside manner could stand a little improvement, but I had no idea how horrible I was. So I was...
You've got to ask.
Right, well, I'm a middle-aged white man. I don't ask.
Right.
Right, I know the answer.
Tell people.
And so that's what I would do. I would tell them. And I would be the equivalent of the medical doctor who walks in looking at the clipboard and flipping the pages and barely looking up at the patient, and then finally saying something like, well, looks like you got 5 or 6 weeks to live, and sorry about that. Be sure to pay on the way out, and I've got another patient. Oh, actually, I have a golf game, so we'll see you next time. Or maybe we won't see you next time. Thanks for coming in. And so that was me. So I'd give this presentation, I'd present the evidence, and I'd just walk away, and these poor people would be going out into the dark night of their own personal souls, and they're just devastated, and I offered nothing.
Yeah. And so
that's horrible.
That is horrible. I mean, the big joke when I first, Karen and I first went to your place to work was that we couldn't talk about the weekend because there wasn't going to be a weekend, according to you. Like, hey, isn't the Super Bowl on this weekend? There's not going to be any Super Bowl. Really? That fast? But obviously, you know, not everybody takes it as a sense of humor when they first hear it. You know, we both know people who have it's basically put them in the fetal position, literally in their closet. And so, I'm wondering, have you had since you put it out there, and since your new book, which we'll talk about in a little while, talks about it, have you had more people approach you personally about dealing with what they're going through with these? With the issues and the data that's presented to them?
Yes. It happens very frequently now. Somebody sends me an email message. Somebody calls on the phone. I inadvertently had my telephone number in a public place. Mm. I was presenting to a college class, and almost always when I present to the college class, I write my cell phone number on the board, right, on the whiteboard. And leave it there for the entire time I'm speaking. Because I know this is pretty heavy stuff, especially for young people. And while I'm on tour, I have this cell phone with me. And so they can call me and we'll talk about it. And that particular presentation was videotaped and it went out to the whole world. And so, there's my telephone number right there for the whole world to see. And bummer, because now people call my cell phone on a pretty regular basis.
So you have to start taking office hours.
Right. And sort of grappling with, what do I do? How am I supposed to process this? I have children, I have grandchildren, and so on and so forth. And so I learned a few things that are very useful for those kind of interactions, as well as for the public presentations and the questions that arise afterward. And I think I'm a much more gentle speaker mm-hmm. than I was a year ago, okay. for example.
Yeah. Your book with Carolyn Baker, Extinction Dialogues, How to Live with Death in Mind, is it used? Do you use it as a tool? Can it be used as a tool for grief?
Yes, it can. And it gets to something we touched on earlier, living here now, doing the things that you think are important now as the Los Angeles Rams Center is doing. Instead of waiting for a few more years, let's tackle the things we think are worthy today. Not 2 years from now, but today. And so that's an approach that we promote in that book. Not only doing acts we consider important in the relatively short term, being here now, living here now, being with the ones you're with, creating moments of joy for those you're with, but also dealing with personal feelings that are anathema to this culture. Mm-hmm. This culture just tells us to push away. You know, there are several grief myths. We're grief-denying culture. For example, there are more than 40 sources of grief. Most people think there are two, death and divorce,
right.
or breakup of a significant relationship.
The taxes.
Death, divorce, and taxes. Right. The big three sources of grief. In fact, we grieve many kinds of losses of jobs, loss of our friends as we move to a new town. There are all kinds of losses that we undergo that can cause us to grieve, that cause us to have an incomplete relationship with somebody or something. And that's really, in many cases, what grief boils down to. The nature of a relationship has changed. It's incomplete. We didn't have time to finish it. So, you know, had we been with our grandparents frequently, especially toward the end of their lives, and interacted with them very frequently toward the end of their lives, and recognized that death is a natural process and that they were undergoing it and they were embracing it and experiencing moments of joy in their final days and hours, then I suspect that relationship would have been complete, and our grieving would not have been so great as it otherwise would be. What we grieve really is an incomplete relationship. So when we break up with somebody, when we get divorced, when somebody dies, there were things about that relationship that we wanted to finish. I never told them fill in the blank.
Right?
And so what we're grieving is our inability to complete that relationship, to tell that person I love them, to tell that person that they were an important part of my life, but I wish they hadn't done these 17 things.
Right.
You know, so there's all these, and again, this is completely consistent with being brutally honest and living here now. So somebody is in your face and is pushing you around and acting like a jerk, you tell them that.
Right.
And I think that's an honest thing you can do that, again, is one of those things that we don't do in this culture. We just put up with that sort of nonsense.
Well, we sort of deny death.
Yeah.
I mean, by denying death, I mean, it takes something like talking about the extinction of your own species to make you realize that you don't get out of here alive anyway, regardless.
Right. And so very frequently, as we go through the grieving process, we're actually wishing for something better or more or different in our interactions with people.
Mm-hmm.
So let's try to do that now.
Right.
you know, let's try to create different, more, and better with the people we're with today, instead of longing for those after the person is no longer in our life.
Right.
And so those are the kinds of things that the book focuses on, as well as a relatively little-known concept called anticipatory grief. Mm. And most of us are familiar with this when we think about it. As our grandmother is dying, and we know she's dying, we're old enough to understand death, and so we know that our grandmother is dying. We anticipate her death, her being gone, and so we grieve even before she dies.
Right.
That's anticipatory grief. You know, we don't have to anticipate, we don't have to employ anticipatory grief for the Panamanian golden frog, for example,
right,
which is already extinct as a result of climate change. But we can anticipate, and some people will anticipate, the loss of so many things around us. The hundreds of species we're driving to extinction every week, the individuals who are in our lives now, the loss of our entire species as a result of climate change, and so on. And so anticipatory grief is something that most people in this culture are unfamiliar with, and even though they've practiced it themselves.
Right. Well, you face a lot of, because of the grief that may come along with the dead, and even if people do accept some of the information they're receiving, there's still pushback from those folks. And the pushback sometimes gets, you know, fairly ugly. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of that and how you try and deal with it, because it's not easy when somebody gets in your face and is not necessarily being nice and being confrontational or trying to sabotage what you're saying. But part of that also might be part of the grief.
Right. Right. And so to connect this to grief, there are these various myths in our culture about grief, such as don't feel bad. You know, we actually tell people to don't feel bad.
Right.
You know, we encourage people to feel good when something good happens in their lives. Nobody gets upset when somebody cheers because they just got a job or they just got married.
Right.
Or you know, these very positive things happen in their lives. We cheer for that, but we deny the fact that they feel bad. So we tell them, don't feel bad.
Right.
And push that away. We tell people to grieve alone for much the same reason. We tell them to keep busy, as if keeping busy will negate the grief, when in fact all it does is postpone it and makes the wound deeper and more recalcitrant. We tell people to be strong. We tell people that time heals all wounds. Mm-hmm. We tell people to replace the loss. This is absolutely heinous in my mind. This is the worst thing we can possibly do, and it happens all the time. You've seen it, I'm sure. When somebody's dog dies, or their cat, or their pet, or in many cases their child, a common response is, when are you going to get another one?
Right.
Or at least you're young enough to have another child.
Right.
Or at least you have your two remaining children.
Yeah.
Jeez, just think about that for a second. It doesn't really matter whether you're talking about a human being or somebody's pet. It's still equally horrible.
It's because it's not really about that person. It's about you feeling uncomfortable because that person's feeling uncomfortable.
Exactly. Because we're such a grief-denying culture, we don't even talk about it. So therefore, when it does come up, of course we're uncomfortable.
Yeah, and I used to do some camps that we dealt with a lot of heavy issues, and people would break down during the camp, and the first thing everybody wants to do is run over to that person and comfort them and hug them and get them to calm down. And we encourage people to give those people space and to let them feel what they were feeling before you rush in and try and take over a situation or a circumstance that you really are unaware of because you're not feeling it.
Well,
it just makes you uncomfortable, so you feel you need to go do something.
Right. We're a do-something culture.
Right.
And that's the other prominent source of pushback. We're a do-something culture.
Right.
And people claim incorrectly that I'm telling people to do nothing, to just lie back and accept your fate.
Right.
Right. And of course, I've never promoted inaction.
Right.
But that's what people hear, I think, because that's what they want to hear, because we're a do-something culture. We're a can-do culture. So
Right. We're
going to use the tool of civilization, by gum, to correct the predicaments created by civilization.
Right. And if we can't correct them, all you're doing is, quote-unquote, you know, promoting and trying to start a suicide death cult.
Oh, yeah. Yes, my favorite thing is if I'm a fan of any of those three, suicide, death, or cult. I'm sometimes called a death cult leader.
Or the Grand Poobah.
The Grand Poobah. I wish I was a Grand Poobah of some kind.
You got a neat little hat.
You know, I used to be third in command in my household, mm-hmm. but since my dog died about a year and a half ago, now I'm second in command.
More responsibility.
Yeah. And so I'm not really the head of anything. In fact, I've promoted anarchism, including in my classrooms for the last 10 years I taught in classrooms. I tried to make them as anarchistic as possible, given that I still am required to assign a grade.
Right.
But given that, there are a number of things we can do in classrooms that encourage people to take responsibility for themselves and for their neighbors.
Right.
And to all of us focus on the subject instead of on the sage on the stage or on the learner as customer, you know, two absolutely failed models for education in general. So I'm not the head of anything. I propose that people live, not die, and that's a primary motivation behind the book Extinction Dialogues, as found in the subtitle, How to Live with Death in Mind.
Right.
And what we suggest is living here now, taking advantage of the fact that there's urgency in our lives and that our lives are short. And even if you live to be 100, your life is still short.
Right.
And so to try to create moments of joy and be grateful for the time that you have on this most amazing of planets. I mean, what's not to like about that,
right?
So I don't understand the death cult thing.
I think what people tend to confuse is that you're just one of the few people who takes the initiative to collect the data, look at it, analyze it, and tell people what you think about it. It doesn't mean everybody has to agree with what you think about it, but people tend to get stuck on a few things, and one of the big things that people get stuck on and that I tend to have to defend you on constantly is the 2030 date.
Right, yeah.
And I tell people that it's basically the dates are not yours, is what I've heard you say, and that the data and research, it's from data and research others have had. And I was wondering if you could kind of expand upon that.
Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, I'm really, really trying hard not to focus on the dates. And people push back for that as well. But I came here to hear the date.
Yeah.
I want to know my expiration date.
Right. Could be anything.
So in this culture, we really focus on the born-on date.
Right.
The birth date.
Right.
But we don't focus so much on the expiration date, right, except for, you know, things like Twinkies. As near as I can tell, don't have expiration dates. And so it does seem a little ridiculous, but the dates come from other people. So, for example, I'm going to quote Paul Beckwith from a YouTube video he posted on November 25th, 2014, so just about a week ago. In it, he says, quote, "Are we in the early stages of abrupt climate change? I think we are. Recent evidence suggests we are. Because these are massive system changes that we haven't seen before, I wouldn't be surprised if global average temperatures were 5 or 6 degrees higher in 10 or 20 years." Finally, he concludes, quote, "These are kind of worst case situations, but they're becoming more and more probable," end quote. Citing the evidence from the paleoclimatic record, Beckwith concludes with a 16C temperature rise and says that isn't out of the question, although that figure would begin about 5C lower than the current global average temperature. Beckwith's optimism notwithstanding, there's simply no way humans survive such a catastrophic rise in global temperature. And he actually cites a recent International Energy Agency report claiming 6C by 2050. 6C by 2050, that's from one of the more conservative, right, bodies on the planet, the International Energy Agency. And he cites that for evidence that his prediction is not far beyond the mainstream, and there's no way humans survive that 6C. Increase either, by the way. And so increasingly, Beckwith is not so far from the mainstream. He's been pointing out the potential for a catastrophic rise in temperature in a very short period of time, and that's bolstered by the Referee Journal literature as well. So I thought I was a doomer until Paul Beckwith showed up. And here's an expert from the University of Ottawa, an expert on Arctic methane release. And he's pointing out that we've had these kinds of events in the paleo record and that we're right in the midst of another one of those right now, that abrupt climate change is underway. And so his is the kind of evidence I present to people and meet a lot of resistance right. as a result.
Right.
And so, you know, a 6C temperature rise in 10 years, for example, that's 2024 if I'm doing the math right, and as long away as 2034 for a 6C rise. But bear in mind, we haven't had a planet with humans on it at 3.5C above baseline in the past.
Right.
So I think even 4C takes us to extinction, as pointed out by Oliver Tickell in a paper he wrote more than 6 years ago now, that 4C is the path for human extinction.
You know, and I think the other thing people miss is that, you know, you're not necessarily doing this to make people unhappy and frighten them. It's a form of resistance. And with the rumblings that have been going on lately in our culture, from, you know, Ferguson to the Middle East, you name it, I think what you're trying to do on some levels, and successfully, because you're getting the pushback, is help people make connections and between what's going on the streets of Ferguson and what's going on with our foreign policy and what's going on with our environmental policy and what's going on with the planet in general. And I think it seems to me that people are having a hard time, in a lot of cases, making those connections. They think they're all separate issues, and they think that the power structure is separate from the environment, and so on and so forth. So maybe we could talk a little bit about that.
Yes, absolutely. Every one of the predicaments you just mentioned is rooted in industrial civilization. So from 2006 to 2012, a white police officer killed a black person at least twice a week in this country.
Yeah, I mean, and that's news to me, and I read a lot of stuff.
This is from MSNBC.
Yeah. You know, not exactly... dissident voice or... You know.
No. I mean, this is as mainstream as it gets.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just... I mean that's Ferguson, and it's been going on for years.
Right.
And again, it's all about the power structure. Who pulls the levers of industry? Well, it isn't underpaid black men, is
right.
it?
Right. Well, I think that's the problem. When I talk about systemic white supremacy or we talk about patriarchy, people cannot see the connections of how those two things are driving their own species to extinction. They truly believe those are separate issues, and when I bring those things up to my progressive friends in a lot of cases, they think I've jumped ship, and all I want to do is talk about the environment, and all I want to do is talk about civilization. And I try and tell them that... You believe the world is civilization. That's not the world.
That's exactly right. And that brings up a good point. You and your lovely bride, Karen, are, I think, the only people so far who have seriously adopted my message and began your own path of walking away from a fundamentally, irredeemably corrupt system more than 3 years ago when you came to the Mud Hut as woofers. And now, of course, you live in a tent. Without putting all the blame on my shoulders, can you describe your path from a high school teacher, from an actually revered, beloved, and successful high school teacher for both of you, to living in a tent at the Mud Hut?
Sure.
And you might start with woofing, because I use a term that people might not be familiar with.
Right. It's worldwide opportunities on organic farms, basically going into somebody's property and helping them out for room and board. Gift economy, really, work exchange. And I think really what it comes down to is what we opened the show with was the piece on Jason Brown, the NFL center, is my wife and I saw we had a small window of opportunity to really step out into a place where we thought we could really feel better about how we were living on the planet. And it's evolved. You know, it was part of resisting the dominant culture. Part of it was that we wanted to leave a smaller footprint. And a large part of it was we just didn't know how to do anything except talk. And so that was really the initial, I guess, the initial urge to go was to do those things. We both enjoyed our jobs. As you said, we were both successful teachers, and it really wasn't the teaching that necessarily drove us out of the profession. It was what was expected to be taught. And specifically me, I had to teach to standardized tests. And I really just came to a place where I could no longer feel good about myself and really promote and encourage students to go out there and become part of the industrial global economy. And that's really what we were doing. There was very little in the curriculum which asked them to think. Instead, it asked them to really just go through and hit all these talking points and make sure you know them when you walk out this door, and at least stick around 100 days because then the school will get paid and get its funding and so on and so forth. And it just became a circus after a while because I was in the profession 12 years, and that's a fairly short time. And in 12 years, you know, everything got recycled. They just renamed it. So we had this new policy that we were going to implement that would change things, and we would name it something else. But it was sort of like we did 3 years ago with a slight twist to it. And I just couldn't do that anymore. And so I took our window of opportunity. We took our window of opportunity, and we haven't looked back. And I think we were fortunate enough to cross paths because you gave us our first opportunity, and it was a positive one. I don't know what it would have been like if I would have gone to some place, to someone that I did not know and had not experienced before, and it would have been, you know, maybe horrible. So I'm thankful for that. And yeah, there's some luck into it, but I think my advice to most people is if you have a window, you need to take it, and very few do. So.
Yeah, and I learned from the both of you as well about living in the moment, about being here now. Let's talk about your recent excursions. You traveled to Europe recently for an extended period of time. Where'd you go? What sort of noteworthy phenomena or events did you observe? Did you notice any behaviors that differed from the American experience, that sort of thing?
Yeah, well, what we did is we actually, after we left your place for our work exchange in 2011, shortly thereafter, we went to Europe and worked on homestead there for about 6 months. And we met a variety of people who were very generous.
And so this is back in fall of 2011.
This is actually a really early spring of 2012.
Okay.
Yeah. So we spent 6 months, basically from about March till September 2012, working on three different properties. And one of them was in Italy, and two of them were in Ireland. And you know, the same experience we had with you. I mean, different working environment, but folks were very generous, opened up their houses. And you have to be a pretty special human being to allow people who are strangers to come into your place and allow them to do work on your property. And there's no money exchange. And so it's a really unique and rewarding way to, I guess, travel and meet people. And so we did that. And this year we returned really just to reconnect with those folks. And we brought my parents along because we wanted them to meet some of those people. We spent 2 months doing that, reconnecting, doing a little bit of work here and there for them, but really just, you know, building our friendships. And I came away this time feeling that at least where we were, and we spent a lot of time again in Italy and in Germany and Switzerland and in Ireland, that at least in those particular countries, it seems that folks are a little more communal than the Americans that at least that have been around in my life. And so whether or not they're in large cities or in rural areas, much more accepting of community and working together and helping one another. And I think we can learn a great deal from really even, you know, American cities versus European cities. You know, Dublin's an incredible city, and people there have been very generous and very giving. It's not a city without troubles, but, you know, it's something we can learn from, even if you live in an urban area.
Well, yeah, I was in San Francisco for this Earth at Risk conference a week or so ago, and that's allegedly the European city.
Right.
San Francisco
right.
is the European city. And I was thinking that as I was backed up on the Bay Bridge and in one of about 4 million lanes of traffic, well, at least six, and backed up for half a mile so we could pay the toll.
Yeah.
To cross. And it's the same coming the other direction.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable how addicted to car culture
right.
we are in this country.
Yeah, and I think that's a big part of it is people don't walk anywhere. There's no interaction. Everybody's in a tin box driving past, though. So.
Right.
All right. Well, should we move on to our Doomer of the Week?
Let's do that.
All right.
Yes.
Each week we set out to find a doomer who not only goes beyond the status quo in their rhetoric or analysis, but may also provide insightful and useful information to the issues at hand. Guy, who's our Doomer of the Week?
Doomer of the Week this week is Binya Weller. She posts the following on the Facebook page for the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group. Quote, "The more I learn about near-term extinction and that it is happening right now and humans killing our planet, the more I seem to wake up. So far that I absolutely don't get it why nobody out there is saying or doing anything. For me, this is so surreal. Average life with its iPods, McDonald's, politics, careers, CO2, hassle, celebrity cult, you name it. I mean, everyone goes on in her life as if it would be worth to support the system, which are collapsing, but they don't see it. It makes me feel insane. I feel like I'm on the wrong planet. Whoops, I am. I'm just glad that I focus more and more on what matters most and get a distance to what makes me sick."
Nice.
Way to go, Binya. I think that nailed it right on the head. And I mean, her final sentence there is awesome. "I'm just glad that I focus more and more on what matters most." And she's trying to get a distance from what makes her sick. And in this culture, there are so many things that can make us sick. And we spend so much time pursuing those things while they're making us sick.
Right.
It is surreal.
Yeah, I guess I would start looking for the window.
Right.
All right, finally we hear from Guy in his climate update.
All right, I've covered a little bit of this already, so I'll summarize. Received abundant criticism from people who twisted my words, as well as the words of climate scientist Paul Beckwith. I'm going to quote from his YouTube video he posted on November 24, 2014. In it he says, quote, "Are we in the early stages of abrupt climate change? I think we are. Recent evidence suggests we are." So he basically took out the "could" that he used in a video that he put out a little over 2 years ago. There he said that these kinds of events could happen. Now he says this kind of event is happening. He wouldn't be surprised at a 16C temperature rise. So tell me again, critics, how I'm misquoting Beckwith and how near-term human extinction is absolutely impossible. The pushback I get, and it's essentially every time from middle-aged white men who, interestingly enough, are right there at the apex of patriarchy. It's almost as if these things are connected. Remember, we've not had humans on this planet at 3.5C or more above baseline. And considering the rapidity of the likely changes ahead, I doubt any of us will live to see 6 degrees centigrade above baseline. Whether that rise in temperature comes within one decade or two is largely irrelevant, except to those seriously afflicted with the arrogance of humanism. Shortly after I participated in a panel discussion on the Earth at Risk conference on November 22nd, Chris Hedges was interviewed after hearing me speak. In the interview, he concluded that we're headed for human extinction in the near term, and to my knowledge, it's the first time he's done that. In the interview, Hedge talks about, quote, "inevitable annihilation. We haven't accepted as a civilization that it is the end. The idea that we can adapt to climate change is delusional," end quote. His bottom line, quote, "it's probably too late now," end quote. It's almost as if people are waking up to reality. I hate to sound like a prostitute, But your own awakening can be aided by my recent book, co-authored by Carolyn Baker, Extinction Dialogues, How to Live with Death in Mind.
Well, you know, his outline there, or his outward is probably.
Yes, yes, exactly. There's always another day.
Well, folks, that about does it for this week. Make sure to like us on our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last, and the Progressive Radio Network, and join our Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM group on Facebook as well. Make sure you post questions you would like us to address because the show is pre-recorded. Please continue to follow Gotti's blog, Nature Bats Last, for further updates, essays, and his speaking tours, domestically and abroad. Also, check out Guy and Carolyn's new book, Extinction Dialogues, How to Live with Death in Mind. We'll see you next Tuesday evening, and if you miss us, make sure to find us in the archives at PRN.FM and rate us on iTunes. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
Nature Bats Last.
Thanks again, Aprazin, for our theme song.
Gonna get you.